Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who always brings eggs and tomatoes to a speech. It's Adam Clement.
Hi, Mark.
So we're a good team, man. You bring the eggs and tomatoes, and I bring the lettuce to speeches to throw at people.
Lettuce is especially vile now because the CDC said that it was contaminated. Actually, that might be lifted by now, but I know that was the hot headline du jour.
The romanity. That deserves
like eggs and tomatoes for that.
That was like a Fantastic Four, Mr. Stretch. Mr. Fantastic. I can't even get that right. That was a stretch.
That was another tomato and egg joke right there, but I'll forgive you.
I just love that in the middle of this incredibly dark superhero film, there's a quick aside by Danny DeVito, who brings eggs and tomatoes to a speech?
Right. No, it's a rare, I don't want to say rare. It's sort of a signature dark humor that comes out of nowhere, I think, in these kinds of movies.
And you know what I do love is that I watch a lot of movies, Adam. And I've always been very bothered by people throwing just little strands of lettuce at people. I'm like, that does nothing. It's a little piece of lettuce.
Wait, what the fuck are you talking about? Please name one movie where this has happened, because it's failing me right now.
You know what? So during the break, I'll just research it real quick. And when we come back, I'll name drop them. Because I don't want to wreck our momentum right now. I am telling you, there are movies where people just throw lettuce at the person at the podium.
But like poultry lettuce, you're saying.
In this movie, though, in Batman Returns, people are throwing halves of lettuce.
No, that's a fair point. You can't really throw, a Frisbee leaflet of lettuce, right? You can only really get some, force.
But they've done that in movies, just little pieces of lettuce. Not like a salad. Not like a salad you buy at a convenience store. Just a little bit of lettuce are thrown.
I initially pictured like a leaflet that you would put on a fucking burger.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what movies are you watching? Unless it's a good burger, in which case, I guess that's probably one example.
I mean, I would buy that though. You're out eating a burger and there's someone being shamed and you just take the lettuce out and whap them with it. Cause there's ketchup. There's probably something on there. There's maybe a little pickle.
Yeah. But why not just throw the whole burger?
I'm not wasting a burger. That's why people throw
lettuce. Yeah, but you're getting rid of, the good stuff.
Wait, the lettuce is the good stuff?
Well, it's not – okay, it's not the good stuff. You're not buying the burger for the lettuce. But I'm saying, I don't know. You're taking a – I don't want to say vital, but a key ingredient out of your equation, which is the larger burger, right? And you're saying, I don't care enough about this experience anymore. I need to make somebody else's day. Shit. And you take that chance, right? You don't know how much weight you got on that lettuce leaflet. So you're sort of saying – pleasure be damned. Here's a face full of lettuce. And I don't know. It just doesn't seem like the risk reward is there.
As I get older, when I was 20, I would have thrown the lettuce without thinking. But now that I'm 36, I'd throw the top bun.
Have you ever thrown food
at people?
Who the fuck else do you throw?
Like a food fight? No, I don't. I'm sure I have in the past, but I've never willingly just thrown.
You're sure you have?
I've always wanted to recreate that scene from The Wonder Years where Fred Savage's parents are fighting and he has to do something to stop the fight. So he smashes a bunch of mashed potatoes on his brother's face. And then his brother goes,
I vaguely recall this.
I have 100% thrown food at people, but I can't recall a single moment of me throwing food at
somebody. Just think that kind of thing dies out after, you're table trained as a toddler.
Yeah.
At least that's my experience.
I mean, I would, though. I would throw the bun. But I have to say, Batman Returns, they throw hat. I would love it if there was just a cabbage truck and people were just chucking massive things of cabbage at people.
Wasn't that sort of like the Groundlings Shakespeare era tradition, right? They would bring or buy produce or whatever the hell and tomatoes. And that sort of, I believe that's where it originated. I'm probably completely wrong. But if 4 years of film school has taught me anything, I think that's probably where it came from.
All right, well, let's look on that during the break, too, and then we'll get back to it. But I just appreciate it. They were throwing whole halves of lettuce at Danny DeVito.
Yeah, well, you sign up for the job of the Penguin. You know what you're getting into, right?
Well, one of them hit him right in the face.
Did they?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd got to be careful with those prosthetics. He had some intense nose action going on.
3.5 hours. All right, we're jumping ahead. So when, if you guys have listened to our podcast before, I've brought Adam in for the Jerky Antics of Michael Myers podcast, and I brought him in for the Halloween podcast 2018. And Adam is, you're like, you know a lot about these movies, and you were really passionate about them. So I was like, hey, what should we do again? And did I bring up Batman Returns, or did you?
That's a good question. I feel like it was a kind of co-op
Yeah.
effort, but yeah, I'm the resident obsessive when it comes to like I handle movies, and I think actually it was probably more you that brought up Batman Returns for whatever reason. It was just serendipitous, I suppose.
I've wanted to
So
cover this
here I
movie for a
am.
long time because it has an audience and it has a loyal
Oh yeah.
audience. And this is a movie that people hate, people love, people don't quite understand. It was a hit.
McDonald's doesn't like
Yeah,
it.
well,
McDonald's hated
I mean,
it.
obviously though, if you're McDonald's and you're putting all these toys out and then you see the movie and you're listening to the Penguin talking about oiling up Catwoman and talking about what he's going to do with his fins to women and then biting a dude named Josh in the nose, like bloodily. And then, all right, how many times do you think Danny DeVito grunt in this movie, Adam? Since you're the
Ooh, that's good. I don't actually. Yeah, that's. I can't say I've watched for that purpose of counting. But yeah, now that you mention it, it's not exactly a kid's movie, is it? And I think they actually, they might have, I might be misremembering this, but I think their big hang-up was the ending, which we'll certainly get to later. But I think the idea of a child seeing, a villain or any character for that matter, sort of gushing black ooze from their mouth, actually from all their orifices, I have to assume. And dying in the dramatic way that the penguin does, that's probably not what they want
And then
to
there's
associate their toys with.
Catwoman sticks a taser in her mouth and kisses Walken and they die.
Yeah, I think as somebody who was like really young when I saw that, I was like 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old, I wouldn't say that was I had weird feelings about that scene, I'll put it that way.
So when I was 10, this movie didn't really affect me. Is that bad? Because I think I'd already watched Reservoir Dogs and Die Hard, and I think I
You
was
were
like,
watching those movies at 10?
yeah, I was that feral child in Florida riding his bike around watching every R-rated movie.
You're a Florida boy.
Yeah, that's right.
Florida boy before Florida man happened. I don't know if that's a great angle because I think as somebody who was very young. And, I literally spent 3 years of my life. I'll pull my mom on this podcast to prove it. Spent 3 years of his life running around as Batman in the backyard. I had a lot of momentum going into this movie. And to be perfectly candid, I don't know if I was actually allowed to see this in the theaters. I think I did because my parents took me to all those Burton movies. They took me to The Nightmare Before Christmas, which actually
Oh
still
man,
kind of
that's
scared me.
yeah.
But yeah, like, I was 5. At that time, and I think I did see it in the theaters, but either way, I had the VHS, I wore it to death, and that certainly had its own impact on me. But as somebody who's 10 like you, I don't know, so we'll have to swap notes.
I mean, this movie, I can understand the studio's hesitancy with this film. This movie was supposed to be so many different movies. Annette Bening was Catwoman, then she dropped out.
Yeah, well, she got pregnant,
Pregnant,
yeah.
yeah. Marlon Wayans was supposed to be Robin. He still gets residuals, which I think is pretty funny. I mean,
Isn't that wild?
yeah, all these different aspects were supposed to come into it. I guess the script was different. People were shooting, like, Catwoman and Penguin were using machine guns to shoot things up, and it was a completely different movie. Batman had more dialogue. Michael Keaton scratched that. Tim Burton really didn't want to do it. He said, I want to make a Tim Burton movie. I don't care what Batman fans think.
Now that you mention it, the script does have some interesting history. Sam Hamm, who was, I think, one of the originators of the first Batman script, I don't think it was just his script alone. I think he had some help, but he had started sort of developing Batman 2. And to your point, if you can even believe it, like this movie is, to me at least, the zenith of what noir is in a superhero movie, at least. And when you look at, how does it get even more noir? It apparently was like. Penguin was straight up, an arms gangster, and even Catwoman at the time in the original script was just said to be wearing straight up BDSM gear. And like you said, they were sort of after some like treasure, and it took place, I believe the final act took place in Wayne Manor. It was very like Maltese Falcony. So yeah, it is interesting to sort of find out like how it could have gone, but I'm personally pretty satisfied with what we got, and I know that's maybe a minority opinion, but yeah, it was a very wildly different movie. And even the Marlon Wayans thing, like, did you have the sort of like action figures from Kenner growing up? Because they definitely put out a Robin figure, and clearly Robin's not in the movie, but yeah, it's just sort of like a last minute decision to pull him. It's interesting.
This movie cost that, so with inflation, $146 million. This was a big budget movie. But what I do love is, I'm not sure, I mean, a lot of overtime and a lot of change in mind, so there's probably a lot of work behind the scenes, but I feel like every cent is seen on screen. The sets in this movie are essentially, the Penguin's lair looks like it was built on the Pinewood lot in England where they do all the massive Bond sets, and they didn't do that, of course. But the sets are gigantic.
Well, now that you mention it, I know the first movie, and I want to say I think I know the first movie was shot on Pinewood. Was
Yep.
the second one, was it not? I don't know if it was.
I thought they went to California because Burton didn't want to go back over there. He wanted to have a different
No,
sensibility.
that sounds right. I don't think that they well, they certainly didn't use the same sets, and I agree that this sort of set design, to me at least, is like there is no other Gotham. This is my Gotham. It's just so full of that sort of German expressionism. It sort of takes that noir from the first movie that Anton first established and drowns it completely in snow. And that's just like I don't see like the Nolan movies, as wonderful and brilliant as they are, I was always let down by that sort of hyper-realism of Chicago and just not seeing those dramatic brutalist gothic designs, dark deco. I believe they sort of coined that term when the animated series was a thing.
And what I guess the first one is more of a noir, if you think about the decisions, if you think about the kind of gangster aesthetic of the Joker's gang,
Right,
just.
and I know Anton first said his inspiration was, it's as if New York never stopped growing. It grew into its own hell. Like, it just kept going.
Well, so what I read about this movie, I found an article on the AV Club that I love. And this one says, more than the first Batman, and possibly more than any other movie that Burton ever made, Batman Returns is driven by a sort of magical, dreamlike logic. It takes place in a world where Oswald Cobblepot can be raised by actual zoo penguins without a single human being, not even a zookeeper, finding out. So, in this world, Cobblepot manages to organize, train, and costume an entire circus-themed gang of criminal marauders before his existence is anything more than a rumor. This movie really has a lot, like, you know how I do a lot of dumb data. I don't feel an, I don't want to do this movie because the
Right, it's
world.
already like so just dumbfoundedly, decidedly dumb
Yeah,
in a
and
lot of
I
ways.
mean the world that this isn't our world.
No, and it's telling you right up front, like literally the movie begins with Pee-wee Herman and Simone, right, from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, giving birth to this monstrous penguin and throwing it in the river stream, and it shows up at a bunch of penguins, and you're like, all right, this is the kind of movie you're in for. Just buckle up.
And then the Penguin starts a gang that can build an entire RV with a giant car video
Oh,
game.
the sort of takeover of the Batmobile,
The
yeah.
technology that his gang members are capable of and the amount of work they can do for, I'm guessing, on the cheap and on the down low, he's found some very good henchmen.
Yeah, these are like pro hackers. This was before Hackers the movie, but you have to wonder what kind of budget they were working with or resources, because like they only just met Max Schreck, who admittedly could, buy them a bazillion things, but they don't have that stuff yet. He just met him. So where these all came from, how he came into contact with the circus crew, who even knows?
I mean the missiles, like what did, well did he kind of build like the Joker did in Dark Knight? He just kind of gets crazy people.
I guess, but yeah, but how do you go through like the process of A, weaponizing a fleet of penguins, and then like training them to use it and all that stuff? Like, I guess they got their little helmets on. I know there's a way of communicating with them and ordering them around, but even still, like, I just, what I love about this movie is just so willfully fantastic, right? In ways
Yeah.
that I think, again, Nolan, to his credit, really saved the franchise for what he did with tying it to realism, but I do miss that whimsy.
And I just, this movie's all whimsy. And then the Batman Forever, I watched Batman Forever like 3 times in the theater. I remember loving it.
Oh, same.
I haven't watched it since. I don't know. I don't know if I want to, but
Oh.
I remember like loving that. But that took the so all right. So the first one was kind of noirish with the gangster
There you go.
aesthetic. Top of the world, ma. Then you have this one, which we say German expressionistic, which is you look at what the cabinet of Doctor what
Caligari,
Caligari.
yeah.
Then you have Nosferatu. You have those kind of movies with just sort of really just jagged
The set
looks,
design
dark
is
shadows,
everything,
yeah,
yeah.
set design, very gothic,
Chiaroscuro.
yeah. So you have, and Max Schreck, hey.
Yeah, I was
It's
gonna say that if that's for the listeners out there who don't know, I'm pushing my glasses frame up right now.
then the
Yeah,
third
Max Schreck.
one goes what? To just Bonkers Town?
Yeah, it's a very different Gotham City. It's basically Las Vegas, but I was gonna say for people who don't know, for those who don't know, Max Schreck, as Mark pointed out, is named after the actor who played the vampire in Nosferatu. Just so you know. So it really does double down on that German expressionism. But yeah, to your point about Gotham in Forever, which I do think you should revisit. I don't think it's nearly as bad as people make it out to be. It's a fun movie. It is not Batman or Robin.
Well,
But to that point, yeah, it's just, I don't know, it breaks away from the Elfman stuff. It breaks away from all the sort of established architecture, and I just it's got the deco thing, but it's just neon, right? It's everything's fucking neon, and they fight a gang of people in glow paint and whatever. That's another podcast for another day.
they had the neon industry was booming for those two movies.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of.
I hope that no new businesses started because of those two movies, because there was never a movie that used more neon than Batman and Robin.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I feel like Batman Forever did use maybe a little bit more. I'm trying to remember the Batman and Robin. I don't watch a whole lot of, and I just have a hard time sitting through because it's more of a straight comedy. And I think that's sort of what Joel Schumacher had been angling for. He just sort of took that homosexual subtext, ran with that, and just made it sort of like, okay, well, this is the fourth movie. What else is there to do except sort of poke fun at ourselves? But yeah, I would not revisit that one. But definitely check out Batman Forever.
So, I guess we should go back to Batman Returns.
Yeah, that's probably well, that's why I'm here.
Now, you know what I love about Batman Returns is nothing about it is subtle. There
No,
are
no.
scenes where you're in the Penguin's cave, right, with his lair, and you see a bunch of penguins swimming in the water to presumably eat a henchman. Then you cut to bats flying around in Batman's cave. So both these
Right.
people are in lairs. But one is underground. I mean, I guess they're both underground, but one is just really, it's like these two kids were both rich kids who were separated, and now
Yeah, it's
this is where
very,
they're
very
at.
Tale of Two Cities. It's funny because I hadn't thought of that. That's a great point. And people make a lot of fuss about Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises, which, it's fine, whatever. And the Tale of Two Cities thing. And I'm like, hello, we did
Yeah.
this in Batman Returns,
I
more
mean,
literally.
and it's not subtle at all. I mean, they punch
No.
you right in the gut with the.
Yeah. And I also just like that there's no frills about there's no pretense, I don't think, with the Bruce Wayne character, right? The first thing we see, well, the first time we see him, excuse me, is of course there's clowns wrecking havoc. What is he doing, Mark?
He's waiting.
He's brooding. He's
Yep.
fucking sitting there with his knuckles and holding his head up and oh, here comes the signal, and he's like, yeah, I was waiting for this shit.
Yeah. He
And
didn't know,
how
he
cool
doesn't know
is
what
that?
else to do.
How cool is that scene too? It's just everything kicks in. The music swells and it's like, okay, we're fucking ready. Here he comes. He's back.
And I love that he has to go fight a weaponized band of clowns.
He does, and he brings guns to the gun show. He does kill. And I know that's a big point of contention for a lot of people. And I was young at the time. I didn't really give a shit about the ethos. The ethics, excuse me, of Batman, but yeah, he gets he sets somebody on fire, and I didn't have a problem with that because they were attacking Santa, and young Adam was very sad about that. I was like, this is a Batman. He was fighting Santa. He needs to die.
And they also blew up a guy and smiled.
Yeah, and that's been memeified to hell, and I appreciate that for its humor. And we don't really see it on screen, so it's like, oh, maybe he survived. But it's still a sort of amusing moment where you're like, oh, yeah, Michael Keaton's not exactly tall, but this boy is, and he can still take him out. So I don't mind that so much. I think we're already accepting of a world that, you know, takes in Penguin Monster Men, and I think Batman Killing is just so far down the list of things to worry about at this point.
I mean, these people are murderers. I was gonna call it the ice cream. The ice queen gets murdered. They're shooting
right,
at people.
Ace
I mean,
princess, yeah.
Later on, they blow up the thing when the Penguin makes his entrance. He kills people there. These guys are out to murder people. They're shooting guns.
Yeah. So it's justified force. I think some people could argue, and even the Ben Affleck stuff is similar. But yeah, I don't take an issue with that so much.
There are these superhero movies where the villain's like, I know where you live. I can break out of every jail. I have so many contacts. Nobody you love or like will ever live, and I will be there to make sure that you die. Everybody that you love will burn, and I will murder you. I'd be like, oops. And just drop them.
Just take care of that.
I mean, I'm not a mass crusader with billions of dollars, but if someone's like, hey, man, I'm going to get out of jail and I'm going to come kill you and I'm going to kill all your friends, I'd be like, hey, your shoe's untied. And then they'd fall because I'm holding them by the foot.
I mean, I don't know if Batman's considered that, but that's pretty effective way to take out your enemies, I suppose.
What, just drop them?
Yeah.
Because I mean, he lets them live in Dark Knight.
He does. And he has issues with Catwoman taking out Bane in the next movie, but he's very conveniently forgiving. He's like, oh, well, I guess she did what she needed to do, and then, you know what, they end up together, and she's suddenly wifey material. I guess that's what Batman looks for. He looks for women who are able to kill and call them wifey material. I guess that's sort of similar to what Catwoman did in this movie. It's just why he was so hot on her tail.
I like them so much together, though. Perfect. Like, when she's like, he's like, I'm leaving. And then she's like, something like, they have really fun His Girl Friday banter that I really enjoyed. And when they, at the end, when they're dancing together and they both find out who they are, she's like, should we start fighting? I'm like, no! Don't start.
Oh, it's
run
such
away.
A great scene.
Go to Italy and get some cappuccino and have Alfred see you there.
No, they deserve to have an awkward, gothic, fucked up marriage forever and ever in his castle. And that's the movie I wanted to see. But it's such a great scene that you mentioned. And I love it because Susie and the Banshees have a track with Danny Elfman, and that it's Face to Face is what it's called, and that was sort of my introduction to goth rock at the time at 5 years old. But that scene is so great because obviously the metaphor, and again, back to your point, nothing is subtle in this movie. Everybody's wearing masks. Who's not wearing masks? They aren't, because the mask is their, you know, their real normal selves. When they put their real costumes on, that's their real self. So, yeah, I always really like that bit before it's sort of ambushed metaphorically and literally by Penguin.
And Batman is annoyed with the Penguin because Penguin is outwardly a monster and he can't be.
Yeah, he mentions that when he's like choking him out, right? He's just a genuine freak and he has to wear a mask. I mean, I think that's true.
All right, so going back to this opening attack, I just want to – there's a couple of things I want to kind of talk to you about. There are dirt bike clowns.
Yeah, those were scary as a kid, for me at least.
And then there's stilts, and there's a guy on a unicycle. These are horribly –
all of those fuckers were really scary.
These are horribly impractical weapons for a gang.
Well, the stilts are impractical. What do you mean by the dirt biker guys? Because that's kind of – I mean, it seemed like they were handling the snow okay.
Yeah, but –
okay, but
have
to your
you
point,
ever seen...
put them in a box and have them blow up out of the box. That's a little impractical. I'll give you that.
Have you ever seen a motorcycle henchman win anything in movies?
You don't really see, like, I don't know. I'm thinking of Raising Arizona. And that's not
Yeah. Well, I did in Mile 22, the very forgettable movie that should have made Iko Uwe a star because he's amazing. Watch The Night Comes For Us because it's the best action movie of 2018.
Oh, I love that. Yes.
The Night Comes For Us?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hands down the best action film of 2018. But, agreed. There's a successful motorcycle henchman in Mile 22, and it wrecked my theory because I'd never seen successful henchmen on dirt bikes. But I don't know. I kind of love this attack. I mean, it sets it up. It reminded me of the troll attack from Ernest Scared Stupid, which is very weird. They're like the same thing. But I kind of love that Batman comes out of nowhere. Oh, and I got to stop. Before this attack happens, Christopher Walken says the word bobbles.
Bubbles?
Bubbles. I can give you more than – I sound like Dracula. Give you more than bubbles.
It's kind of impossible to mention Chris Walken in the same breath, not do a guys, fellas, it's me, Max Schreck.
Yeah. I gotta have
expensive
more
bubbles,
yeah.
Right?
I just want to listen to him say bubbles.
I love that. First of all, he is the main villain in this movie, and I think a lot of people overlook that. You know, you don't see him as a figure, you know, in toys, obviously, because who wants a fucking Max Schreck figure? But he is sort of the Dr. Frankenstein of both of these monsters, right? He has created Selina Kyle's Catwoman, or at least sort of incited that, and he sort of cultivated this political monster, right, which is perfectly timely
don't do
and comically
it. Don't
relevant.
Do it.
Oh, okay, I don't like to make political posts, but, you know, again, these kinds of movies, however fantastic, it's funny how you can sort of draw these real-world comparisons. But, yeah, he is the main villain in this movie, and it's easy to forget that.
And he wants to build a power plant that sucks all the power from the other power plants.
Yeah, I liked that very quick and brief exposition when Selina finds out. That's like all you need to know. He's just power hungry. He's so power hungry that he has a power plant that wants more power. That's all you need to know.
And he's that power hungry.
And he loves his son, Chip.
And dude, Chip's a good son.
Okay, he might be a good son, but that guy, Andrew Burns, I'm going to botch his last name, not a great person in real life. Apparently, he was also Leatherface in the remake for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But yeah, I don't want to be catty and spill the tea, but apparently he's not a wonderful person in real life.
Oh, no. I think he was in Mortal Kombat, too, as one of the bro ninjas.
Was he really?
I don't know. Watch Mortal anyway. Kombat again, the fight with Goro, and all the ninjas that are under the control of, what, Shang Tsung? Is that the guy?
Shang Tsung is the big bad, but yeah. Goro's his right-hand man.
One of my favorite bad fight scenes ever. It's one of the biggest red reads on my site. Everyone comes with the breakdown I did of it.
When Johnny Cage fights Goro?
Yeah, he just punches him in the... Oh, so the suit was so cumbersome, all Goro could do was lift his arms up, and then Johnny Cage just does a split and punches him into balls.
True, but for the time, I'm pretty impressed with those practical effects. I love that.
Oh, no, I love that movie in 95. That was huge for me. But, so Selina works for Walken. She's super mousy.
Mm-hmm.
She forgets his speech. She's like, I'm going to punish her later. I'm going to get some baubles. And he doesn't say that. But the attack happens, and Selina goes back to her house. It's like a cat pad, which I don't see anything a problem with because cats are amazing. And
they really take that crazy cat lady thing to the extreme, which I'm okay with.
I mean, like, the guy's breaking up with her, and she has a real bad life. And then she goes back to the office, and this was what kind of troubled me. So she goes back to the office, and she breaks into Max Schreck, Christopher Walken's encrypted files.
Yeah, and uses the password of his pet chihuahua.
And I'm like, you shouldn't do this. Why are you doing this? And she figures out everything. And I'm like, what? Huh? And then Walken kills her.
Yeah, and I mean, we obviously needed a reason for him to act, and I think just being really good at her job was, I guess, probably the path of least resistance. So I didn't mind it, but boy, that transformation scene that comes right after, I mean, talk about a highlight. You got the best, probably, character motif by Danny Elfman created for that scene, and just seeing her unravel, I mean, if there was anybody still waiting for, like, Annette Bening to prove herself as a Catwoman character, like, that was far in the back of their minds by the time that scene rolled, because she just owns it. And it's very unlike, you know, the Catwoman of the comics, who is, you know, more or less a cat burglar. But I think this is a liberty that Burton took, or excuse me, the screenwriters that they took, that was well earned and paid off immensely.
She has 9 lives in this movie.
Yeah, she does.
Literally, and... like, legit 9 lives.
Yeah.
Now, what was I going to say? So this year, during this year, Marissa Tomei won the Oscar for My Cousin Vinny, and I loved her in that movie. I haven't watched it in 20 years, but I remember when I watched it, I'm like, man, she's amazing! So I can get why she won the Oscar. But I think Michelle Pfeiffer's performance, after watching it again, is Oscar-worthy.
Yeah, and I think in a post like Heath Ledger winning an Oscar type of environment, that would have absolutely been like nominated at least. I don't know if she would have won, but that sort of legitimacy, right, wasn't really a thing in 1992. So yeah, I agree. I do think that she earned it, especially wearing that corset. Holy shit.
She's really funny. She pulled off a gag about kitty litter. She manages to be like conflicted, badass, emotional. Like, she puts a bird, a real bird, in her mouth.
Oh my god, that's right. Yeah, that was not faked at all. Everybody says, like, she straight up did that. And that probably was against the insurance policy they had her on the set, but yikes.
Yeah, I mean, the bird lived, so that's good. And she's like, I didn't even think about it, or any diseases I could get. But I know, I just love her performance in this. And so when she, obviously, she takes the hello there sign, breaks it down to hell here.
Hell here, yeah.
Makes her awesome suit. And what I kind of love is she gets her introduction, you know, she beats up a criminal, but I love when she's introduced to Batman and Penguin.
Right.
Because,
just meow.
Yeah, she,
just meow.
She does all the flips, and right. Batman and Penguin, they don't care. They're really, there's, well,
they're in the middle. They're in the middle of something. They're like, okay, who's this bitch rolling up on us with her, like, gym moves, right? And then she just, like, is panting after her show off, because she is, she's showing off. She could have easily walked over there. And she goes, meow, and it's just like, boom, the coolest, most epic entrance. Like, hey, guys, I'm a problem for you now. And, of course, you know, Penguin chases her, but still.
But Penguin goes, I saw her first, and then he takes off.
Gotta fly. Which, can we talk about the mechanics of that umbrella? That's just like, for a movie loaded with, you know, complete impracticalities, a wire, motorless umbrella propelling a very porty Danny DeVito is pretty wild.
You know what, though? But in the way this movie, the world of this movie, you buy it.
Yeah, you do. And one thing that we sort of mentioned, that she took the time to learn how to use that whip, too.
And then she bust up a dude's face on her first, like, when she was practicing. She cut somebody pretty good.
She might have, but I think that she got so good to the point that that scene where she takes out the mannequin heads was, like, actually one of the earlier takes they did, which is impressive.
This is going to be random, but this movie sort of reminds me of, the Happening.
Oh my gosh, how could it possibly?
All right, so in our podcast, which you should really listen to, I said that the Happening doesn't take place on our Earth. It takes place, it's an alternate Earth where everyone talks like the people in that movie talk.
Okay.
So their talking is normal. So that's why in this movie, that movie didn't bother me, because I'm like, oh, this is like another universe. This is not,
sure.
this is Twilight. But this movie, when his umbrella flew him up in the air, I was like, yeah, that works. I get it. It's all good.
Oh, sure. I mean, I didn't give a shit as a kid, but, you know, just pointing out all the things that are just wackadoo about this movie, it's kind of up there for me.
Do you think Burton cared?
Well, obviously not. He was given, like, carte blanche for, like, whatever he wanted to do with this movie. And people argue that it's more of a Burton movie than a Batman movie, which is, like, fine, whatever. It's a convenient headline. But, yeah, I think it's still true to the spirit of Batman. It may not have a very, you know, profound character arc for him besides the Selina thing. He's a tragic character. This movie, I mean, look, we can talk about how Christmassy or not Christmassy this movie is, but if we're going to talk about Die Hard being a Christmas movie, this is probably my favorite anti-Christmas movie. It's just so goddamn bleak. I mean, it's so against convention. The movie ends, nobody wins. Selina, who knows where she's gone? We know she lives, but she doesn't. Her life is forever changed. Bruce is going home to his mansion alone. And obviously the Penguin, he couldn't save him. He tried, and he just couldn't do it. So you don't talk about, like, just depressing, bleak movies that go against a superhero's convention. It's up there.
Yeah, try to humanize the villain, kind of like, and Black Panther did that to a certain extent with Michael B. Jordan.
Right, and you know, it's interesting because I usually hate when a movie, especially with, like, Halloween's Rob Zombie remake, or, like, even, you know, stuff like, bad example, but Hannibal Rising, like, anytime you start humanizing a villain to make them sympathetic to the point where you're rooting for them the entire time, I don't like that. I think it sort of robs them of their novelty and their power as a villain. But, you know, by the time Penguin croaks, it's very disturbing. But that Elfman score, man, if you're not shedding a tear over those fake penguins waddling his corpse into the water, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I just, that's a very emotional scene for me, and it's silly. It's, like, ridiculous.
See, I'm the opposite. When he got knocked off, I'm like, I don't have to listen to any more fish smacking.
you weren't feeling that.
And he murders that nice guy. He's like, are you sure we should steal children to murder them all? Because he wants to kill every firstborn.
Oh, yeah. He goes, like, isn't it a little And the penguins goes, no, it's a lot.
And then he kill
it's like, this movie is about killing kids.
Yeah, he wants it. And then this his scenes with Catwoman. So he just made me so uncomfortable that when he bit it, I'm like, he made his bed. I guess he is a tragic figure because he got sent down there, but the path he took was beyond redeemable.
Right. Like, he's not so sympathetic that you're too sad for him. But I think the imagery and the music do it for me. I think you see it as like, well, this guy had a horrible life and he wasn't accepted by society, which is classic Burton trope, you know.
Wait.
Just this idea of outsiders who cannot, whether that's Batman, whether that's Catwoman, whether that's the Penguin, you know, it's tripled down here.
So when these, you know, when those penguins walk the penguin when after he dies, they're not touching him. So I wonder if there's this like a magnet they've set up, like, does, so I'm not saying that's a gaffe on the movie. Maybe they set up a weird...
It looks to me like they sort of guide him in. I don't know. They're certainly not holding him. They don't have opposable thumbs. But it does look like they're nudging him at the very least.
Maybe they just have a weird magnetism that he uses. Maybe they develop something down there.
I mean, the penguins apparently raised him as a child. So, you know, that's not maybe so far-fetched.
And they were big penguins. Those are dudes and penguins. Those penguins were 5 feet tall.
They did, yeah. They used a mix of real penguins and certainly fake ones, and those are definitely smaller actors.
So that means in the sewers of Gotham, there's 3-foot to 5-foot penguins roaming around.
I mean, is that so unbelievable compared to, you know, gators in the sewers?
I think so. I would be more terrified if I saw a gator in the sewer, but if I saw a penguin in the sewer, I'd be very confused.
A penguin with a rocket?
Yeah, that's 5 foot tall. I mean, that's an adorable army.
It is. It's so cute, and you don't want them to die. So by the time they use their rockets on the lair, you're like, oh, at least they don't die. That's cool that they sabotaged their owner.
But they blew up their own lair.
Yeah, but you know they're fine. They're better off without Penguin. Like they've been doing just dandy.
He didn't have their best interests in mind.
No, he was like. He was running with the wrong gang, quite literally. He was with the Red Triangle Gang.
And they left him.
They were like, see you later, bye. Dude, when that bat ski boat, oh my gosh, how awesome is that bat ski boat?
I know there's
boats in like the later movies or whatever, there's planes and stuff, those are cool, but like Batman had a very specifically engineered kind of a sewer sub, really. To sort of weave through the underground. I thought that was badass.
And he takes a perfect jump and wipes out the penguin's duck 4x4.
Yeah, he dodges the missiles.
Oh, I love that movie. All right, so how about this? Let's take a break. I really want to know about this lettuce thing, so I'm going to research some lettuce things. And when we come back, we're going to talk even more about Batman Returns, and we're going to unleash our 5 favorite superhero movies of all time. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And I was right, Adam. In Citizen Kane, in The Graduate, in The Heat of the Night, in Scarface, in Return of the Jedi, in Schindler's List, in 12 Years a Slave, in Shame, lettuce is thrown.
Wait, in Shame, the Michael Fassbender?
Yep.
When did it happen in that?
Some lady's not pleased with him, so she just throws a bunch of lettuce at him and says, shame.
I mean, I guess that movie... I guess that's the scene I don't remember from that movie for all the other scenes that exist in that movie, but that is amusing to me.
Yeah, I mean, that was so Steve McQueen, the writer-director of that movie, he wrote the movie because of the lettuce scene. That's where everything stemmed from.
Jesus Christ, Mark.
You know that?
You've done it. You've gone and done it.
I'm basically just the never-ending fountain of knowledge.
I hope your students are so just lucky to know these little nuggets of knowledge.
I do want to say, I went through the entire 90s with them through independent film, and I showed them El Mariachi trailers, and I kind of taught them about Slackers and Dazed and Confused and Clerks, and I walked them through Friday. I walked them through all the independent film, and it was pretty awesome. And they were clapping when they watched The Graduate. They loved the ending of it. So, you know, despite my lies about lettuce being thrown in Shame, I think I'm doing them pretty well.
I would love to be in your classroom.
It's good. It's a good class. I had someone come in and sit in. They're like, man, you know your stuff. So praise all around. Give me a raise. All right. So we're talking about, there's one thing you said you really wanted to touch on during the break, and that is that this movie is a Christmas movie. Did you want to explain further?
I guess that much is obvious. I think anybody who's seen this movie knows just how again, it's not subtle in the least, but one thing that I think meshes so well is the new score that Danny Elfman does for it. And it's hard for me to pick between this movie and the first one because they're so similar and they're so different. I wouldn't even say they're siblings, they're almost like cousins in a way. But it is definitely, for me, Elfman's most ambitious score, I think. And I might be forgetting one, and maybe you can help me with this, but he composed over an hour of original music for this. And he wasn't really rehashing any of the old motifs. Like, even the Batman theme has a bit of a new iteration. And I, you know, as a kid, riding his bike around the neighborhood in his little Batman cape and cowl, those are the themes that sort of I would hum in my head, right? And everybody has those. If it's Superman's theme or what have you, I think it's crazy how pivotal that was to me as a kid. So much so that when I saw him at Lincoln Center performed the music of his works for the Tim Burton movies, I was there front row center at Lincoln Center, and I couldn't keep my shit together. I was just so emotional about it. So, you know, having listened to this music for so often for as many years as I have, I often turn to this and think of Christmas. And it's sad because it's a pretty lonely Christmas movie. I mean, it's a very bleak and dismal one for all the reasons we've sort of discussed. But I think when people talk about Die Hard being sort of the unconventional black sheep of the genre that doesn't or may or may not belong, this is the movie I think of. I don't know about you. Are there any movies that you sort of say, you know, it may not be a Christmas movie, but I watch it anyways? This is the movie that I revisit, you know, on Christmas Eve.
National Treasure.
Wait, why National Treasure? Does it take place during Halloween? Excuse me, Christmas?
I watch it during Thanksgiving. I like to watch it during Christmas. It's just a nice
movie. That's just your thing.
I just enjoy it. And I watch The Goonies during Thanksgiving.
The Goonies during Thanksgiving. That's so interesting.
I don't have a Christmas movie.
You don't have one that's like outside of the genre? Outside of the immediate classics, right? Like The Christmas Story and The Wonderful Life and Christmas Vacation and blah, blah, blah.
I don't watch any of those during Christmas.
So you don't partake.
I have so many movies to watch during these. I've been watching the Hallmark Christmas. If you go to MFF Facebook and click like, you'll see that I've been ranking all the Christmas movies that I've been watching. The Christmas Chronicles is number one.
Right, the Kurt Russell one. I was going to ask you. I know you're a big stan for Kurt, and I was tempted to watch it for that reason. Is it worth it?
Oh, absolutely. Just go in there. Like, so these movies, I think some people go into these Hallmark, Lifetime, Netflix movies with cynicism ready. Like they have their
preconceptions and their expectations all ready to go, ready to hate on it. And it's like, that's cynical and that's expected. Who wants to do that? Who cares?
They have their quippy remarks ready. And so for me, since I've watched a lot of these movies, they're all the same. So I really like the good ones. I know that.
Yeah.
And they don't even have to be that good. They're not horribly stock, or they don't make me yell at the screen 8 times.
Right. And I was actually, I'm not proud to admit it, forced to watch, was it the Vanessa Hudgens
one? Oh, I love
one?
That one, dude.
The Christmas
That's
Switch.
So much
okay,
fun.
But okay, so you'll know then. I got the impression that this was like, wow, holy shit, been there, done that in every conceivable way. But then I read, and this might have been fake news, that it was a plot more or less determined by like a Netflix algorithm saying like, oh, the whole switcheroo thing with distant lookalikes and they fall in love with so-and-so and the royalty and the prince and the pauper type allegory. It just seemed like that's what it was going for and that's fine and dandy. So I didn't hold it against it, but I was just like, not really my cup of tea.
I mean, there's always these themes of where it's always, for some, it's never a man. It's always a woman who goes back home because she has to help her family. And then she moves back or she has a bad job. And then she leaves this, you know, like this sad sack that she left years prior. And he's just all still mad about it. And you're supposed to like him. It's a very,
right. Well, either that or like, it's, you know, some city woman who goes back home to find like some unassuming, unexpected love romance with some down home country boy.
And they make billions of dollars just making one greenhouse worth of poinsettias. So, I mean, but actually that one wasn't that bad, poinsettias for Christmas. No, but I want to say I did, since I've watched so many of them, and for me, I watch so many movies so I can write about them. And what I like about these Christmas movies that I think a lot of people don't get is that millions of people watch these movies. These movies Remember Christmas Prince last year, how much press it got?
Yeah.
And that thing was all over the place. And so
yeah,
these
that was
movies,
pretty wild.
They aren't going anywhere. They're becoming a factory. They're making a lot of them. And they're kind of getting an audience. I think they're starting to really gain steam. I don't think they're going anywhere. So
well,
I like
I think,
knowing about them.
Right. And they've always been there.
Yeah.
I think the conceit of these movies, at least the business value, right, is the idea that you're marketing Christmas or whatever holiday you subscribe to based on nostalgia. All of our memories about the holidays are from previous holidays. They're with our families. They're with the memories that we have watching these movies with our families. So to retread on any plots or conventions is like completely accepted and embraced. So we'll get 1,000 more Christmas switches, 1,000 more Santa Claus movies. That's just the way it's going to work. And that's,
yeah.
It's like, whatever, fine.
They shoot these movies in 3 weeks. They knock them out really quick. A lot of them are shot like probably a lot of them are shot in Canada. There's one shot in Louisiana. They shoot in major hubs. Some shoot in Utah. So there's a basic area of where they shoot most of these movies. And I mean, you recognize certain homes. So it's just a big business churning stuff out. I did watch one the other day where they, instead of snow, they were using white blankets. We caught that. That wasn't very cool.
Wow.
I do think Hudgens crushes that, though. She's, as far as actors go, she had fun with it, I think.
Yeah, it looked like she had fun. I'm not one of her biggest like fans as an actor, but yeah, she does the job.
She was good.
She's fine. That fake accent. Come on now.
But that is a fake accent because it was a character doing a fake accent.
No, I know that. But even before she makes the switch or whatever, like well, as the royalty person.
Yeah, but she's from like Stankonia or something, and when you watch these movies, any foreign European country, they all have British accents. So maybe that's just the way they speak in this fictional country that she's from.
I'm willing to suspend my disbelief. That's fine. What's wild is that back when she was like at the height of her, you know, High School Musical fame, I remember people even then were like, oh, yeah, she's totally got that Catwoman look. And we're like, you know, parading for her to become the new Catwoman, which, you know, is kind of silly in my opinion. But she does have that, you know, exotic look. I think that'd be
Spring Breakers. She's gangster in Spring Breakers.
I forgot about that. Oh my gosh, she was in that, wasn't she?
She's a gangster in that movie. And that's
I just remember this. I remember the Selena Gomez, and yeah, I don't remember her in that one.
That's where I'm from, St. Pete. But all right, so let's go back to Batman Returns. We just went off on those. Let's pretend that was a listener question that we answered. And so
yeah.
thank you, one of our listeners from. You know what I learned is was it Nambia? We are pretty highly ranked amongst their TV and film podcasts. So thank you guys for no Namibia.
Yeah,
Namibia.
Like that.
So thank you guys. Oh man, I just butchered it. Hopefully I didn't lose our audience. I'm sorry guys. But yeah, thank you so much for listening. But yeah, we'll get back to Batman Returns. So
yeah,
I mean, I kind of hijacked that because you were talking about what kind of movies do you watch or kind of there. It takes place during Christmas, but it's not really a Christmas movie. Were you kind of getting on that wavelength?
I mean to say like, I actually would argue that it is fully intended to be a Christmas movie. I would only argue that it's not in the traditional sense for convention's sake, right? And never mind the fact that it's not a happy movie. But again, back to my point, like, it ends pretty sad. Like, nobody wins. Penguin dies. Batman failed to save him. He failed to save Catwoman. Selina, excuse me. Max Schreck is dead. He is not brought to justice. That's not really justice at all. So you're sort of leaving the theater, and I think that's probably the problem a lot of people had with this movie, the ones that don't like it. You don't really have a victory, right? The hero didn't save the day. He saves the kids. But, I mean, does anybody really want to see kids killed on Christmas?
Getting dumped in toxic.
I'm all for a dark Batman, but I don't know if I'm ready for that.
So that's this is interesting. So you really do leave the movie on a downer. Now, I watched – so I know this is a completely random aside, but I'm going to do it. I went and watched Bohemian Rhapsody, and I enjoyed it. But it's basically just a biopic or biopic.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, but it does seem like a very paint-by-numbers biopic.
It absolutely is. But it ends with the 20-minute Live Aid performance. So when you leave –
because that's the only way you end that. Yeah.
So when you leave and the music plays at the end, there's some fun songs and you're singing along and you see all the pictures of the band and Rami Malek really crushes that performance and you just hear – it's basically like a recreation of the concert. And so you just leave on a high.
Oh, sure.
Oh man, like that movie was great, but it's a stock biopic.
Yeah.
With very funky editing, but it leaves you on a high. This movie, you're watching Batman and you're like, what?
It's kind of funny too, because, you know, again, it's not Bohemian Rhapsody. It's not, you know, Mamma Mia. You're not going out the theater singing along to some high or songs that were in the movie. But this movie ends very emotionally for me, that I enjoy it, that I am very satisfied. I love the fact that when Bruce is in the car with Alfred, he finds the cat in the alley and he thinks he catches a glimpse of Selina. And it's just so melancholy. There's a point at which it's literally when he bends down and picks up the cat, and the music, violins, the strings just sort of swell. And he walks back to that car and he's just so resigned that he's lost her. And, you know, but, Alfred, he just, come what may, Merry Christmas, Mr. Wayne. And they just drive off. And of course, you've got that sort of cookie at the end where the stunt double for Michelle Pfeiffer shows up and it's like, oh, she might be back. But that never, of course, came to be, unfortunately, or not. Maybe it was better that way. And I just love the way it ends, because it's so epic in its own way. It's not epic in a way that leaves you cheering. It's epic in a way that's like emotionally profound, in a way that I think the first movie was, in different ways. Because in the first movie, right, he wins and he beats the Joker, he's dead, and you've got the announcement of the signal, which everybody's waiting for because you haven't seen it yet. And you make this, before you even get to the tower sequence, Vicki Vale is waiting for him, and she gets in the car with Alfred, and she's not surprised that he'll be late. But yeah, that march, that reprise, before that hits, you get this sort of thunderous march. And you see Batman sort of towering over the city with the bat signal. And I think both movies end in ways that are very, like, satisfying for me. And I think they tried to emulate that, right, in Batman Forever, with this sort of ridiculous, the bat signal is facing the camera and they're sort of running toward the camera, right, where it's like, we'll be back, maybe. I don't know. It just felt very staged and phony. But yeah, just the way the movie ends, I think Batman Returns, it's sad and profound, but it doesn't, I don't know, it's not depressing in a bad way. It feels like this sort of big, warm blanket that envelops you and says it's okay to be sad sometimes. Like, that's the movie for me, as ridiculous as it is.
It's a compliment to Michelle Pfeiffer and Michael Keaton as well. Just, I mean, they don't really have many scenes together, but you just like them together for some reason. And I really
they're magnetic, yeah.
I love that scene where, like, can you believe that they said Catwoman was 140 pounds? And then he was like,
all right.
And then he says, oh, can you?
Batman blows it.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean? There would have been a lot more property damage. So I like that they weren't even listening to each other, but then they had that scene.
Their psychoses are always front and center. Yeah. And even when they have their outfits on, right, like that kiss under the mistletoe is just so freakishly. It's just so psychosexual. It's wild.
I love that line, though, when she says, you know, it's going to be a dark time in the cold city. I think that's my favorite line reading in this. Isn't that what she says?
I'm probably going to get it wrong, but I think it's going to be a hot town in the cold. It's going to be a hot time in the cold town tonight, maybe.
And then he looks at her and goes, you got a dark side.
Yeah, he says it literally like that, like as aloof as anybody else would. He doesn't even have that sort of Christian Bale, suave, debonair persona, right? And that's what I love about those movies, is that Keaton totally went all in on this, like, completely neurotic, unassuming Batman. He's not this square-jawed, you know, macho motherfucker. He's a pretty fucking weird guy in real life.
They have their dinner scene, and they're way across from each other in the first one, Kim Basinger and him. Mm-hmm. He's just like a squirrely dude.
Yeah, he is. And even in this one, doesn't he make mention of Ted Bundy, Norman Bates, on the couch? He's just like afraid of being taken as a psycho, and he's like, yeah, you kind of are.
Because they're talking about, what, duality, right?
Yeah, well, they're talking about letting people in, right? And he was mentioning that things didn't quite work out with Vicky, and she goes, ice skater.
Oh, yeah. There's two, ice skater or something else. Did she get two options? Yeah.
So that scene is wonderful, and obviously they get, you know, intimate, and they're sort of like discovering each other's battle scars, and that's also a really compelling point of that bit.
And when they have to leave, I like that Catwoman tells Alfred, she's like, "Can you just tell him a dirty limerick?"
Yeah. Who even says, like, and what does he say? He goes, "One is just sprung to mind."
Yeah. I love that scene.
And I love Michael Goh in the role of Alfred, and I think most people would probably take their Michael Caine, but
No.
He was always my Alfred.
No, I almost busted out my Michael Caine accent, but I'm not going to do
it's
it.
It's okay. We already did our Chris Walken, so you're entitled. That's okay.
It's horrible. But the podcast, people have heard a lot of my Michael Caine, so I'm not going to do it. It's really bad.
Well, isn't the cheat to it is to say his name, but don't say Michael Caine. You say my, as in possessive, cocaine, the drug.
My
so
cocaine.
You just go,
whoa.
Yeah, that's literally it. That's all you got to do.
Michael Caine. No, I can't do it long, though. So I always should. No, I'm not going to do it because we don't.
Spare the listeners then.
But
yeah.
I really like him in this movie, too, because he's just working with him. Like, I love watching him at the computer screens, Alfred, in this. He's just this older dude crushing this computer.
Oh, my gosh,
work.
You're right. We didn't even touch on the fact that they fuck Penguin shit up.
Yeah,
with the CD player mix over the intercoms
waka, 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 waka.
Yeah, it's like, haha, motherfucker. Yeah, I mean, it's only slightly dated now, but yeah, it's a kind of a neat scene because there's often complaints, right, about Batman not being a detective, not using his intellect. But that's I would say that fits pretty squarely in what Batman would do. He uses his tech savvy to sort of start villains.
Yeah, and then, I mean, Joker gets lit up and he gets hit by eggs and tomatoes and lettuce.
Oh, Penguin, you mean? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Penguin. That's what I meant, not Joker.
Yeah.
I'm getting it mixed up.
Yeah, no, it's a great scene. And you mentioned before, like, the part where Penguin hijacks the Batmobile is pretty amusing, too. And I have to imagine the production for that was pretty intensive. And how cool. I mean, like, again, the movie is just over the top ridiculous. So you're kind of maybe expecting it. Maybe I wasn't, but... just that sequence, right, where he's being tailed by the cops and he's caused enough damage already, so you're already feeling really anxious, but he's got that sort of very small alley exit route, and you're like, how's he gonna get out of this one? And sure enough, you know, being Batman, he's thought of everything and he's engineered this car to completely convert into a missile and just sort of sneaks right through that that crevice. I just thought that was the coolest thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then his car flips up and spins itself around in this one.
Well, when does that happen?
That thing comes down from the middle of it, and then it lifts it up, and then it spins it around and then drops it.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about the beginning. Okay, so yeah, the pivot.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, the Batmobile doesn't look like it takes three-point turns too easily, so that came in handy for, of course, what setting the guy with the blowtorch on fire. He was like, fuck you, here's my fireball.
He lit that dude up.
Yeah, he literally lit him up.
He just killed
it's
him
a great guy. Scene. I mean, you can pretend like, oh, Batman doesn't kill or whatever, and that's fine, but it's still a cool scene.
Can I ask you a question about comic book movies?
Yeah.
So you love a comic, right? You love one certain comic. They make a movie that isn't what you want.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts?
I think they're similar to what I sort of broadcasted in my Halloween review / rant. And, you know, I think a lot of people have problems when it comes to their established headcanon. And that's the key word, right? Your headcanon. Because that even varies from comic to comic. And I'll try to make this as short as possible. But comics have such terrible time with continuity. It's so difficult, especially a character that's, you know, endured for 80 years, 75, 80 years. So that has never been a problem for me. The story is everything. I'm here for a story. If there are inconsistencies, damn them, whatever. So when we're talking about something not fitting from page to screen, I'm pretty lenient with that kind of thing. And in this case, I think you're right to pose that question because I feel like it's almost the ultimate litmus test, whether that's Batman killing or the Joker, or excuse me, the Penguin's origin, which really doesn't fit in any way with the comic. And even Catwoman, which had an amazing revisionist origin. She was, I believe, always just sort of a cat burglar type. I mean, even in her first appearance in Batman 1, she sort of was established already as a thief. And it wasn't this sort of pitiful woman who learns empowerment, right, in her primal side. It was sort of something, I don't want to say that Burton and company came up with that, but that's something that definitely wasn't firmly established in the comic lore. So I appreciate these digressions, I think. And, you know, we're getting a lot of that talk now with this Netflix thing with Cowboy Bebop and anime and all these other types of pop culture. So no, I think just being able to sit back and take something for what it is important.
I don't want the same thing over and over. I don't want a remake. I mean, just look at it as another run of an issue. Look at it as, you know, what, Mark Millar doing a run.
Yeah, and those originals will always be there. It's not to say that this new shiny thing is somehow suddenly more important by proxy.
Do you think that just a lot of comic book fans, they kind of grew up, were sort of introverted and got into this world? And they kind of grew to kind of to love this character? And so They've become
protective. That's a great point. And I think it's easy to label nerds especially as being toxic and, you know, so-and-so. But I think you're right. I think it comes from a place where they associate so strongly with something that either helped them through a tough time or something that they identify with. And once that identity is compromised in some way, especially vis-a-vis a quote-unquote normal population, right? A new accessible audience is coming into this circle of theirs that was once very exclusive. Maybe it feels less special. Maybe it is diluted. So I think it comes from an okay, a well-meaning place, but it can and does often turn toxic.
Got it. I feel the same way. I just want to talk because this movie just delves so differently from anything Batman had ever been.
Yeah, and there is merit to the argument that it's not a very good Batman movie. I think the movie has a lot of criticisms, and I think that one's a valid one, but I still love and adore it for many other reasons.
Yeah, I hadn't watched this movie, I'm telling you, probably for 15 years. I watched it last year. I was very surprised how little Keaton was in it. And he cut a lot of his lines, because he was supposed to make he had monologues when he was in costume.
And that would have been so wild to see. I can't even imagine it. I really can't.
And it's weird that he cut his lines, but I still think he's effective in this movie. And I like
everything. Every interview he's ever given on this, he and, you know, you can call this lazy, but he's right. You're walking around, even in this movie, you're walking around in a costume that looks like a bat. Any more acting in this and you're overselling it. Like, you walk, that thing sells itself.
Yeah, that's. I love that scene where in the beginning when he saves Selina Kyle from the taser, the taser clown by shooting the thing behind his head and pulling it back and knocking him out, and then Selina talks to him and he just looks at her, then he walks away. I guess that is all Batman. I mean, if you think about Bale, people make fun of the way he talked when he was Batman.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. The less said about that, the better. But you know that scene you mentioned, it's a very Sergio Leone bit, right? There's sort of this face off and any more words. I mean, what could he have possibly said to make it cooler? Yeah. Really? he's Batman and that's it. And he walks away and that's that.
Also, Keaton isn't cool.
He is not as a person, but I think that's definitely changed. Like, I think most people see him as a pop culture icon for whatever different reasons. You know, he was a comedian first, he did Mr. Mom,
Beetlejuice.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely changed. But you're right, back to the point where he was first cast in the first 89 Batman, there was a huge outcry just knowing that this might be a comedy movie, that he wasn't right for this role.
Why is Mr. Mom in this movie?
Right. Well, they wanted Bill Murray before that even, which is just wild. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he had a rep for not being like cool, but I would argue otherwise now. I think at least for the past few years, especially, his stock has risen considerably. So
he just has that very neurotic vibe. Even when, you know, most, if you think other guys or Multiplicity or even Birdman, he has this wire. He has a wiry. Yep. So I guess what I'm thinking is he has this very wiry kind of kinetic energy, which wouldn't translate well in Batman, so maybe he felt more comfortable being silent when he was
right,
Batman.
And I think I think that's fair, and I think we're also talking about two different types of cool. There's the sort of suave, calm, confident, and then there's the, wow, this guy's fucking crazy and unhinged type of cool, and I think
Keaton
sort of taps into the latter a little bit more, but I'm blessed for that casting. I just think that Burton always talked about the selection process for that, and he always talked about having seen more rugged, traditional, conventional actors for that, and he always talked about how Keaton's eyes really sold it.
So all of my favorite heroes, I mean, I love Indiana Jones, I like Jack Burton. I like Sean William Scott from Goon. I know that's a hockey movie, but I like action heroes who aren't the big swaggering, I never got into the Stallone or Schwarzenegger, those big, sure. Like, I'm not like that, or the like now what The Rock is becoming, Statham's becoming, those have never been my favorite kind of action stars. Back in the day, JCVD, I know that he beat up everybody, but he would get beat up in his movies and he would act vulnerable. So I think that added to the fight scenes because you're like, man, he's losing. You watch him now and you're like, the people he's fighting have terrible game plans. But for some reason when I was younger, I love Jack Burton being out of his league. I like that Michael Keaton is Batman. I love that
idea.
And
he's not very tall either. He's like 5'10".
So I don't know. I guess that's why he's always been my favorite Batman, just because of that fact. I mean, the other ones were fine. I never took Clooney seriously. Well, he didn't have a chance.
He was sort of robbed of material. But you're right. I mean, I'm looking right now at my sort of Hot Toys 1/6 scale Batman and Batman Returns figures. And, just in terms of the costume alone, like I don't think there's a better costume on film. It's so impractical, but it's just the coolest. It's just like a fucking Lamborghini.
He had to learn how to like punch with his torso. Like he couldn't move a lot with his shoulders and neck. So he had to like punch from the torso.
Right. They call that the classic, the Batman look, where you turn using your shoulders.
And you know what's interesting? I guess we'll keep moving along, but I'm kind of jumping ahead here to Catwoman. So you have Batman, who always has this pristine costume, and Catwoman's costume slowly begins falling apart.
To unravel, yeah.
And
yeah,
so does her mental state, which is another it's not a metaphor.
Classic film techniques, yeah.
I guess it is a metaphor, but it's not hidden. Sure. It's not Malikian. But I like that aspect of her. I know it just went from Batman's costume to her costume, but I love
how that's totally appropriate.
It just became more disheveled as she went along, and so did her mental state. Because unlike Batman, they both became something kind of different. She adopted the cat. He adopted the bat. He had the money. He had the power. He had Alfred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had a guide. He had that. So when she donned hers, I think she really it just was different circumstances from when they first put on those masks, and it led to something completely different because they had different support systems. And I don't know, I thought that was interesting.
No, you're right, and we are lucky to see that. And I also mentioned earlier with the music and such with her unraveling sequence, but it is a highlight. And you often get the complaint about those movies that you don't see that for Bruce Wayne's character, and you don't see that really until Batman Begins. Which I think Keaton actually and Burton wanted to sort of explore in Batman Forever before they sort of were jettisoned from the project. But I don't know, deep down, if I'm being honest with myself, I don't know if I want to see Keaton go through that. I feel like there's so much also gained, especially as a comic book fan, from just seeing him in his maybe first year starting out in that 89 Batman. I like that he's sort of established. I like that we're cutting to the chase, so to speak, because, certainly Batman Begins being its own great story and all that. I don't know if that fits aesthetically. I don't know if it fits with the Burton thing. So I don't know. I could be completely wrong, but I do appreciate that we do see the transformation for Selina Kyle Catwoman in a way that we obviously didn't for the Bruce Wayne character.
I don't want that. I love how he became a fully fleshed character, and I love how in Batman Returns it's too late for him to be kind of going back to normal because he just waits around being called to hurt people.
So I appreciate the brooding, constant brooding.
I kind of dig that about him. So before we move on to our favorite superhero films, any last thoughts about this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every time I'm on this pod, I talk about movies that I'm just obsessed with, which is probably why I'm on here. But, this is a movie I saw when I was 5 years old and running around in Batman costume every other day. So it's important to me. And I think when people talk about it being fans, they're talking about it through the lens of nostalgia, which, right or wrong, is very different than the fans that might talk about The Dark Knight or whatever recent Nolan movies. And I'm certainly a fan of those too, but I think when we talk about being fans or liking Batman Returns, it's for very different reasons. And I guess you know, for people who say it's not a very good Batman movie, there's merit there, but I do think it does not get enough credit for doing all the things it did differently and going so against type, whether that was casting or merely challenging the conventions of a superhero movie, which admittedly wasn't so firmly in place yet. Right? We didn't have the Marvel formula and they weren't a dime a dozen yet. But yeah, I do think this is a movie that sort of transcends the genre in, you know, for better and worse. And for me, I think that just makes it all the more special.
And so when we go over our five, I guess I won't break up the discussion, but I have this at number three of my favorite. Now, not best, favorite, but right. I have this at three because Burton wanted to do something different. I think so many of these superhero movies that are out today, while they're good, while, you know, they have 90% Rotten Tomato scores, I get it. 90% of people could easily like these movies. I don't think there's no stakes to them. I don't feel anything.
Right.
I think Marvel's incredibly smart. People are going to be screaming at this thing, but I don't consider any of them great films. I know that people are going to be angry at me about Dark Knight, and I do think they're good, but I don't know. There's so many that come out right now. I like them. I'll buy them. I worked on some of them. So I really think they're good movies. I think they're done really well. I think the cast they have are perfect. But what I love about Batman Returns is how just different it is. It's grotesque. It's German expressionistic style. Toss in some very cynical Christmas themes. You have Christopher Walken saying Bobble. You have Danny DeVito going all in on the grossest character ever. Michelle Pfeiffer. So she's in this incredibly tight outfit, but you also really like the character. It's not just like they're not just like shoving her in something. Like, this goes with the character.
Right, she's not there just for eye candy.
Yeah, and just the character, as she like falls apart, you have the very, you know, obvious metaphors between Penguin and Batman. You have Batman brooding. You just have the overall
That I think, people don't give it credit for, I think.
And I was talking to Megan. We were going on our nice nightly walk, my wife, and she's on the podcast. She's listened to it. Our Bad Times at El Royale podcast and Apostle. It's very good, very, very well researched. So listen to that. But so I was talking to her, and I was like, I watch so many movies that I think the movies that I love the most are the ones I actually remember. And I know that's really bad, but a lot of these movies I watch, I just forget about immediately. But Batman Returns has always been just whether he's biting noses or
there's really nothing like it.
Yeah, there it is. There's nothing like it. They tried something different, and I know they had to do a Batman reset, but I love this movie. I think it's very well performed. The actors are all in. It's beautifully constructed. The sets are great. So that's kind of my take on this film. And even if it is a different Batman movie, who cares? Like, there's so many different variations of Batman. Like, go back to your old that Batman that you love is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, that's what I got to say about this movie. You want to jump into the list before we get too philosophical here?
Sure. Yeah, I don't know if I have it ordered like you do, but I certainly have a list to rattle off.
All right, let's start five. What do you got at five?
Five? Oh my gosh, Mark, I don't even know if I can do five. So, all right, I'll start with this. I love the first two Spider-Man movies and Homecoming. I love Batman 89 and Returns, obviously, and The Dark Knight. Just some like occasional new modern ones that I like. Logan was like transformative for the genre for good reasons. But man, when it comes to like favorite ones, I don't even know if this is an accurate list on my part, but I would name drop something like The Phantom at five.
Billy Zane?
With Billy Zane, yes.
Nice.
It's just like such a fun-spirited serial brought to life, and I just never thought it got enough credit. Like, it's silly, it's fun, but it just feels, it's just a joy to watch, really.
I love yarns. I just dropped National Treasure. I love the 2018 Tomb Raider because it's just a yarn with Walton Goggins. She goes to an island and looks for treasure, and there's any movie where you gotta walk on floors that are falling underneath you, or there's just caves. I'm all in for. So I have very fun. I treat Williams chewed the scenery.
Oh yeah, as a great villain.
Yeah, it's a fun. I remember going to a theater and watching it. So I mean, I definitely had a good time watching that movie. That's a fun one. My five, it's newer, but it's Wonder Woman. And I know people complain about the CGI fest at the end, and I still don't understand why the Amazonians gave up the high ground to the Nazis. Like, why don't they just stay up on the mountain and shoot arrows at them? Why attack them on the beach?
No.
But what I like most about this movie is Patty Jenkins directed, and the performance she got out of Gal Gadot, it's so, I don't think I've ever seen a performance like that in a superhero movie. It's just open. It's curious, but she's also a badass, but she's just still new to the world. I
Right.
thought she and Chris Pine were really good, but just what Gal Gadot added when she ran across No Man's Land during that World War I battle scene,
Oh, it's iconic.
and then everyone behind her runs, and she just doesn't understand why people are telling her not to do all this stuff, and she's not doing it out of a bratty way. There's no,
Right. She
like,
just she knows no other way.
and when she's walking around with the sword and in London, I don't know, I had, for me, I just, that performance just, was perfect, and I
Well,
really, that's why it's in my five, because I just thought that she really crushed that role.
she did. She earned, I think, the confidence that she might not have had going into it, because a lot of people were still nitpicky, as fans will do with women in these movies. But you're right. I think that movie especially really brought back what the feeling of aspiring to be a hero should feel like. And I, going into the movie, which I agree with you, I loved. One thing I really wanted to feel, and maybe I'm giving away my next few entries, was to feel the way I felt as a little boy watching Batman 1989 at the very end, seeing him tower over the cathedral with the march playing and the bat signal. That just felt so triumphant and so special to me as a little boy to have something even so silly as a superhero to look up to. I wanted that, and I wanted that feeling for little girls. And I, being a 31-year-old male at the time, seeing Wonder Woman, had that feeling again, and it's just like, that's wild, you know, to
Yeah.
recreate that is
Yeah.
just really special.
So I love that Jenkins directed it. I just thought, I don't know. And I do have to say, a lot of people were angry about Gal Gadot, which is insane. But I was working Comic Cons at the time, so I was hearing it.
Right.
And I was like, have you watched Fast Five or Fast and Furious Six? Like, have you seen Furious Fast? Like, she and Sung Kang are really good in that movie, and she's a badass. And
Yeah.
have you watched the Fast movies?
A few of them, yeah.
So in the sixth one, her and Sung Kang have this relationship, and she dies at the end of Fast and Furious 6. And I had a tear in my eye. So I'm serious, because they
You loved
were,
her before Wonder
well,
Woman.
they were a great couple. And she was in Fast 4, 5, and 6, and she was really great in it. And when they got cast, a lot of people were like, oh, but I'm like, no. I was like, yo,
Right.
watch the Fast movie. She's going to crush it. And then she
Yeah, I
crushed it.
honestly had no real experience with her on screen before Wonder Woman, so I was sort of blind to that as well.
I was in the theater patting myself on the back, because I'm like, I told everybody.
Yeah.
But no, I you know what? I actually, so my last year I was working this job. It was a nightmare. I was like 18 different cities, always traveling. This job was just, like a massive long days. Wasn't the best way to kind of, wasn't the best job. It was a job, so I'm not gonna complain. And saw a lot of the country, I won't complain. But I saw it in a packed two-story theater in San Francisco, and I would say 70% of the audience were women. And so I went by myself, got a beer, popcorn, sat down, and just everyone was clapping, cheering.
That's wonderful.
I've never been in a theater like that. I've never seen that before with that kind of
Yeah.
character. And so, I mean, just the cheers and the clapping and no one was like being obnoxious with phones out. They were just loving
Sure.
every second of the movie. And I think that also really made a great experience for me as well. So that's why it's kind of one of the
No,
coolest
that does
things.
sound really special. And it's easy to take that for granted even now. I mean, how long would the movie came out, what, last year?
Yeah.
And even now we've got what, Captain Marvel on the way, and we've got Black Widow on the way, and we're, I guess, maybe more desensitized to the idea. But at the time, like, it's so wild. A year ago, we still had not had that kind of caliber of a superhero movie led by a woman. And for it to perform as well as it did, to be as good as it was, just it was a watershed moment in and of itself. So I completely agree.
Cool. What's your four?
Oh man, I wasn't prepared to rank, but I honestly, going off that last thread with the Phantom, I think the Rocketeer
Oh, yeah.
was one of my favorite old Disney movies that sort of defined their early 90s strategy, right? Before they got super safe and sanitary. And I mean, look, this movie had Nazis for villains. So
Yep.
I do think it was a very big risk on their part, but I adore it. I think the score is beautiful. I think the, oh my gosh, Jennifer Connelly in that movie was just like instant crush.
Yep.
So, you know, Timothy Dalton as the big bad. Everything about the movie, I just think, is very well done nostalgia. And that Joe Johnson directed it, of course. He had worked on similar serials like Star Wars, was the perfect person for this job. And obviously, he would go on to do Captain America, but you know,
Jumanji.
yeah. But you know, again, off that serial theme and being right for that role, I think Joe Johnson really brought out a great movie from, I guess it was a comic book, I'm a serial maybe,
Yeah.
I forget, but. Yeah, that movie was always very enjoyable to watch, even as a kid, and I didn't quite understand the significance of, you know, Nazi Germany, but yeah.
I keep using this line, but it's just a good yarn. It was just old school throwback
Yeah.
PG.
Well, these were movies that were not created in a factory, right?
Yeah.
These were movies that weren't made to be franchises. They were just like, hey, let's make this movie as maybe this is being naive, but they wanted to make good movies, and it wasn't necessarily predicated on the idea of making four more after.
And I know it was based on the serial, but that costume just looked great, whoever set that up.
Oh, it's iconic,
And
yeah.
just the fisticuffs and watching Dalton swing. Yeah, I love that movie. That's a good pick, man. It's better. I did Iron Man for my number four.
Okay.
Just because when you look at Marvel now, this movie was a gamble. You got Jon Favreau, he did Elf, he did Zathura. Those were his big movies. And then you had,
Swingers.
oh, yeah, oh no, Lyman directed that.
Oh, did he? My apologies. Yeah.
Yeah, so he had the background. He had made good movies before. And then they brought in Robert Downey Jr., who he was off Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the success on that. He was amazing. But I have never
He was
seen.
still in the throes of his comeback. He
Yeah.
was not a guarantee.
And this is a tentpole movie that's going to start off a Marvel Cinematic Universe. And from the first second that he is on screen, he's a fully fleshed character, Robert Downey Jr. He is like just, he is, as soon as you meet this guy, you're like, I love this guy. This guy's amazing. And I love this. I don't like, this is my favorite Marvel movie, MCU movie. I'll phrase that. It's my favorite MCU movie just because the scene in the cave, he makes this shoddy suit and there's danger. There's, you know, his heart has that problem. So he has to build, like, you know, they have to
The
keep the
stakes are
magnets.
there,
Yeah.
yeah.
And so he's just this guy in a suit who built it. And there's stakes and there's really great casting and just with the rest of the world around him. But just to watch that scene where he builds this suit and, you know, there's stakes. And that has, I don't think that's been felt since. And I also love the scene where he won't let Jeff Bridges eat a cheeseburger. And he's like, I mean, Jeff Bridges is like, did you get one for me? He goes, no. I don't know. I love it.
Yeah, I think that movie definitely benefits from Robert Downey Jr.'s real life persona, which I think, you know, is certainly a caricature, but it, yeah, I think when they handpicked him, I mean, look, didn't they want Tom Cruise at some point? And yeah, he's like the go-to, right? He's very passable as an eccentric, rich, white man, but, you know, can he rock a goatee and carry the movie like Robert Downey Jr.? I don't know.
I guess I just, and I also saw this one in Korea by myself. Yeah,
Interesting.
so I got good stories for these movies, but it was in a packed theater and everybody was laughing and loving it. And I don't know, I just, you know, man, The Rocketeer's really good. I should have put that on there. But I just think the way that he's so fully fleshed out in the opening minutes. I
Right.
don't, you don't see many movies where you just know the character immediately. That very rarely happens for me, and that
Yeah,
happened here.
the exposition in a lot of those movies can be a bit of a chore, right? Even with like something like Bruce Banner, who is an interesting character. Usually you go through the motions. He's a scientist, blah, 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 blah. Okay, fine. But with Downey, you know, sort of the moment you see him on screen, he's got this charisma and you know immediately the kind of person he is. And he still develops an arc, like he still develops, quote unquote, a heart, so to speak, right? He sort of assumes this role as a hero despite himself. And, you know, he's both, right? He's a hero and he's also a complete vain playboy type, but yeah, there's still an arc there, and I think there's change and development.
Yeah, who's your three?
Oh, three, Three gets a lot of leniency because I don't know how well it's aged, and I think most people would fight me and say that the second entry is better, and it is, but for all intents and purposes of being the watershed moment it was, and I think a lot of these movies are in their own way, right? I would say the first Spider-Man by Sam Raimi was unlike, I think, anything. It wasn't like anything we'd seen before because, you know, we had X-Men. There was sort of a drought. Or actually, was X-Men before it? I
Yeah,
forget. But
X-Men
it was
was
just before it, right?
2001, and then Spider-Man was 2002.
Right. So we were still kind of sort of in a drought after Batman and Robin sort of tanked things and studios got a little skittish. But this thing that had been worked on by James Cameron and all these other people for years, and I mean, it had been in the works for decades, really, if you want to get down to brass tacks, finally made it to the screen and it didn't suck. And it was inspired. It was by somebody who loved the character, Sam Raimi. And yeah, they made weird changes like the organic web fluid, but like, and yeah, Toby, excuse me, was a little bit old for the character, but with everything else, it just, I mean, like I said, I think that's probably my point. This movie has a lot of flaws and it doesn't hold up super well in the climate that we have, which is overstuffed with these movies. But with the Power Ranger suit that is the Green Goblin and Toby being older and, you know, whatever concerns you might have for Mary Jane being not a great character or Kirsten Dunst's performance, I still adore those features of this movie. I adore the Sam Raimi score. And I think at the time it was a movie that was responsible for so many things to follow, in a way that Batman was, or in the way Superman was. So yeah, you know, I was the perfect age for this. I think 2002. I don't even want to say how old I was, but you know, I was in high school. I was ready for this movie. So I would say, in spite of its shortcomings, or maybe blemishes that are very visible today, I would say that that movie played a pretty big role in my life,
It's
movies especially.
the tone was set immediately. The
Yeah.
world, the feel of it was fully realized by Sam Raimi. And so I'm gonna, my number three is Batman Returns. We'll skip that. My number two is Spider-Man 2, so we can maybe
Okay,
segue
yep.
into that,
Sure.
which I think is it flip-flops to be my number one occasionally, but I just
It is
think
the better movie.
the Doc Ock relationship, where you have the full-on crazy surgery scene that's full Sam Raimi
Full
and
Evil Dead, yeah.
full Evil Dead, and then you have the train sequence, which I think bang for buck is probably my favorite action scene
Yeah, that one's really up there. They went all
and the
out.
people on the subway pick him up and carry him. I laughed during that scene for some reason. I love the
Oh.
Bruce Campbell cameo where he's trying to shush him.
Yeah.
I don't know, I love the doc I like human villains for me, so I guess the movie's at, well, the fifth one doesn't really count, but the villain's terrible. But I mean, you have Jeff Bridges in the fourth in Iron Man, then you have Joe, Penguin and Catwoman, then you have Doc Ock. I just like this. There's humanity to him, and I just thought the action scenes, the CGI, the world, the story, the cheesiness. I loved every second of it. And
It blended very well in a way that was very true to comic books. It felt like that comic book aesthetic.
You watch, what Spider-Man Homecoming, where he attaches the ship together and all these different scenes. Like, that's what Toby was doing in
Yeah,
this
winks and
one.
nods to that one, yeah.
And so, was he out of high school by this time in this one? So he was in college.
He was in college in Spider-Man 2,
Yeah,
yes.
so, he's a little bit older. They kind of jumped him ahead. And I don't know, I just love Spider-Man 2. I can't get enough of that movie.
Yeah, I like that a lot, obviously. And I do really enjoy Tom Holland as Spider-Man in Homecoming. And I think that they're setting up a wonderful world for that as it continues. But yeah, that first one, it was so memorable for me.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, $100 million opening weekend broke all the records.
Yeah, I think it
What
was
the?
actually 114.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that crazy? I was watching the box office. I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah.
What's your number
I
two?
think we're on two,
Yeah.
yeah. This one's a cheat. I have a lot of movies on my list that I was not sure I was limited to five, so I have an unofficial tie, but they're not really tied. I would say for two, you know, Batman Returns, Batman 1989, and The Dark Knight, I love equally for very different reasons. And I think I sort of mentioned that earlier with Dark Knight being hyper-realist but more dramatic as a crime story, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, these movies, I just – it's hard to pick. And I think nostalgia wins out when it comes to 89 and Returns. But those three, you know, what more could you really ask for a Batman movie? And I guess we'll find out if Matt Reeves gets his way. But those are definitely up there for me.
With – you know what's crazy about Dark Knight? It just I had to deal with so many Dark Knight fans.
So yeah, one of those movies that really had the Fight Club syndrome, where everybody was like either Tyler Durden or Joker talking about, you know, waxing poetic about philosophy and anarchy. And I'm like, okay, I get it.
But like, hey, Mark, what are your favorite movies from the 1970s? Oh, you know, I like Star Wars. I like Alien. Well, where's Dark Knight? I'm like, wait, that's not in the 70s. Like, but that's what the fans were. So I'm kind of projecting this onto myself. I mean, the cinematography by Deakins is brilliant. I mean, second to none. It's probably the best-looking superhero movie ever made.
Was it Pope or was it Deakins? I don't think it was...
Deakins did Dark Knight.
I thought Deakins did Interstellar, but I could be mixing them up. At any rate, yeah, the cinematography is superb. And, you know, obviously the performances are great. And I don't love Batman's grumble voice, but I do recognize it for being literally transcendent.
Oh, it's Wally,
for what the genre is.
Wally,
there was
Feist,
Wally Pfister.
Pfister.
Yeah,
they went.
Could be Pfister, actually. I don't know if his name is Pfister, but yeah, the cinematography is excellent. And they obviously did the IMAX for a lot of those scenes too.
Oh, the opening scene. I mean, that was just brilliant.
Yeah.
Heath Ledger took it next level. All right, hey, number one.
So I was hoping this would be a bit of a surprise, because maybe you or anybody who actually knows me listening would have expected me to say Batman 89 or Returns. But, you know, maybe I feel like I'm betraying my real feelings on this. But I do think, if I think long and hard about this, and I did, I think, you know, point for point, my favorite superhero movie might be Mask of the Phantasm.
Wow.
I do think it's, in and of itself, the single best iteration of Batman we will ever get. I think it has every element that's necessary and vital. I think we have the best Batman voicing him. I think the story, being as tragic as it is, works really well. The whodunit aspect, the Dark Deco, obviously you got the Joker, who isn't the main villain. It just feels perfect. It really does. In every way, you get a little bit of everything, and they spend time a little bit on the origin, not too much, but the scenes that delve into those bits of history, they feel weighty and they feel important. And that's not something you would expect from an animated movie, right? That came at the tail end, that followed something like Batman Returns. You know, even at that age when I was a kid, I was like, oh, it's coming to movie theaters, so this is going to be a good movie. And I don't think I appreciated it quite as much at the time, because I love the cartoon. You know, I still love the cartoon, and my love for that cartoon has only, you know, grown stronger with age. But, you know, again, to think about that kind of a movie, that animated movie that made it to theaters, I don't know. It just feels so serendipitous. So that does. Probably my number one, and I could go on and on about it, but right. Mask of the Phantasm, I feel pretty confident with.
Unbreakable was my number one.
That's fair. And I bet you're excited for Glass.
Yeah. It'll be good.
I hope so.
It looks like
Shyamalan's back on track, hopefully.
Yeah. Do you know I wrote an article back in 2014 saying he needed to go back to – or 2013 saying he needed to go back to $5 million movies, and then he made The Visit, and then he made the other one, and now he's back up. So he probably read my article, and that's why he's here.
But you're already here first. Well, his success is all credited to you.
I just love Unbreakable because – so Mr. Glass, Samuel Jackson, is a guy who his bones break. So he thinks, hey, there's probably someone on the flip side. So he does some horrendous things just seeing what will happen.
Right.
And that, like, just saying that gives me goosebumps. Like, that's an amazing villain right there. And he reads all the comic books. He's aware of them. He has an upscale comic shop. Like, before comics were cool, he had this.
It is a very meta movie in that way. I think it's meta in a way that doesn't seem overly self-serving.
And
it feels organic.
And I love when he fights the guy, the prisoner guy, because that's one of the most nightmarish sequences
No.
I've ever seen. He follows the dude in the yellow jumpsuit to a place, and the guy's just standing over an emaciated woman spitting beer on her. It's just like it's a nightmare scenario, whatever.
Yeah, but, and that's another movie that really goes against type, right? It sort of challenges those conventions that are well founded by now. Because that movie came out when?
2000.
Okay, so it was before the big boom again, but there was still. It wasn't what you would call a superhero movie.
Well, let me check real quick. Unbreakable. So he made, you know, Sixth Sense comes out in 99. Yeah, 2000. Sixth Sense comes out in 99. Everyone's expecting the greatest movie. Unbreakable drops. And people are like, oh, it's all right. It didn't get. But I think it's. I don't know. I think it's brilliant. I think just for him to churn that out in a year with the plot it has, with the cast, I thought Bruce Willis really brought a lot to it. I know it has the somber tone of a Shyamalan movie, but that's just the world that it's in. And I don't know. I just love the idea of Mr. Glass. I think that's just a brilliant villain. He's just, there's someone the opposite. I know it's super simple, but there's someone out there who's the opposite. So I'm going to do these things.
Yeah, and I look for that kind of simplicity in movies. I think that's why Halloween ranks so high for me. But that sort of adoration, I think, and appreciation for Unbreakable is certainly evident with the – well, I don't think any of your listeners have not heard this by now, but with the surprise twist at the end of what was the James McAvoy
– Oh, Split.
Split, yeah. And then, of course, with this new movie, I think – this sort of – it's a surprise world building, right? People didn't anticipate this getting a sequel the way it did.
Yeah, I almost picked my wife up and ran around the theater with her.
Is that how you found out? You found out in the theater?
Yeah, I didn't know. Because I try to stay away from a lot of stuff.
Right.
And so when I found out, I was just like, oh, my gosh. And then, you know, the trailers look to be expanding the world. I like the idea of it. But I just love how simple it was. I just liked – I'm a huge Sam Jackson fan. I liked his different kind of role. I liked just, what a brilliant idea. So that's my number one.
That's fair.
Man, thank you for joining us, bringing your Batman Returns expertise.
Yeah, well, who knows how many more movies I'm good for. I feel like my list of obsessive fanatical movies is dwindling after Halloween and this.
Oh, there's no more?
No, I assure you, there's definitely more.
All right, we'll make that a series. Your obsessions.
No,
it makes my job easier. I can just let you. I can set you off, and then I can hang out. Go get a burger.
Throw the lettuce. Throw the lettuce. You don't like things I say.
Yeah, I wish there was like one of those emojis that you can throw. You'll just get a lettuce on your phone.
Yeah, well, your listeners will miss out on that. But that's right. Yeah.
But this was a lot of fun. I've been wanting to talk about this movie for a long time, and you were a perfect guest to have on. So this is movie that it's worth talking about, and I love this movie. It just has personality. So I'm glad we got to do it. But
agreed.
Yeah, stay tuned for next week. I got a ton of things coming up. We got we have Reign of Fire coming up. We have Rio Bravo versus High Noon. That's a really fun one that we're going to do. Two Westerns that are completely different on purpose. And then we have Home Alone 1 and 2. So we got three of those coming up. And then whatever Adam is obsessive about will be on the way soon. But thank you so much for listening. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Adam Clement, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.